What do you think like the top five vegetables should be then?
Well, I would have to say for one, dark leafy greens. And, I think kale can be, I happen to like kale, but I know that it can
Kale
be
is so divisive.
so divisive. Yeah. But I'm not recommending that. I'm saying that like I like it. I don't really have, any major issue digesting it. But I think arugula is phenomenal.
I love
Romaine
arugula.
lettuce. Yeah. Mixed greens. All great. All great. And super nutrient dense. Because they're rich in folate and vitamin C, but they provide very few calories, which increases their nutrient density, right? By definition. We know that people who eat a bowl of dark leafy greens every day have more youthful brains, so brains that perform up to 11 years younger.
Meat of all kinds, including fish, I'm sure,
Yeah,
right?
absolutely.
Proteins. Then you've got fruit, vegetables. What's next? Are we to wine yet? Because if we're not to like chocolate and wine, I just, you know. Hello, welcome to the Pretty Intense Podcast. Thanks for listening. Today you're in for a treat. Max Lugavere is on the show and he shares all of his great knowledge about food. And like he has this amazing approach to life that I think is going to be contagious, or I hope so, because it's so balanced and beautiful. He is a wellness journalist. He has a podcast called The Genius Life, and he's written two books called Genius Foods and Genius Kitchen. So check those out. Man, we just covered cool things. We talked about like some of his loves and interests outside of food even. And he's got this famous smoothie and you've got to hear what's in it because it's super good for you and keeps your blood sugar really stable, which is kind of a rarity with smoothies. We created a food pyramid. So you've got to listen to the end to hear the food pyramid because I think it's epic and I want to implement it across the board. I know you're going to also hear like how people end up getting to develop the food pyramid and who gets in to do that. And I'm just going to say it's probably not fair what they try and tell us to eat. But Max has the solution. All things health and wellness and all things balance and a great way to approach life and great ways to look at things like vegan, carnivore, dairy, all kinds of things that have like stigma or like there's like, what do I do? What do I not do? He has some great answers. So, thanks for coming back. Thanks for listening. Please hit the subscribe button and let me know what you think in the comments. Who really likes to listen to their voice anyway? Do you ever listen to your stuff and you're like, oh God, it's like nails down a chalkboard?
I have
I
to listen to
hate
my voice at 1.5 speed, like on podcasts. Otherwise, I'm like, oh, why do I talk so slow? Which I don't think I talk slow, but when I'm listening back to it, it's just like, come on, get on with it.
Maybe you process that fast.
Maybe. I
Do
do
you listen
listen to
to other
things.
things at 1.5 speed?
Yeah, I typically do. I typically do. I think that there's like, yeah, our brains are able to process information faster than our lips are able to convey information. So,
I agree with that. I
yeah.
listen to books at as fast a speed as I can digest it, which usually falls at that 1.5 to 2 sometimes.
Interesting. Interesting. Do you actually sing, though?
Actually, truth is, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a singer. And I
Amazing.
took voice lessons when I was really young. And the teacher would like touch my stomach. And I thought, and he was, it just grossed me out. So I quit.
Oh.
I stopped after that summer's lessons. I was like, I'm not comfortable with this old man sitting at a piano touching me. So
That's pretty cringe, yeah.
I guess I could have been a pop star, maybe. No, I don't think you know what I like to joke? I harmonize really well because when the music's up and I'm singing, people are like, wow, you sound pretty good. And then I turn the music down for myself in the car. I don't know if you've ever done that before, just to see how you really sound. And I turn it down and I'm like, not so great.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I love I actually sing and I but it's something that like I've learned over the years. I've taught myself. I've worked really hard to be able to do it, and it's like it's so gratifying and fun to be able to do.
How do you teach yourself?
Well, I think at a certain point I realized that enough people in the world can sing and can sing well that there's got to be something teachable about it. There's got to be something that, that it's not magic. I mean, certainly some people are born with beautiful tones and they are practicing since they're like toddlers. And that certainly wasn't me, but I just figured that there had to be something like that I was able to learn about doing it. Like when I before I learned about singing, I thought that people just kind of like it was just a different way of talking, and some people sounded better than others, you know. But you actually have to, I didn't know that you actually have to use your voice to hit certain notes, like scales on a piano. And once I learned that, I had that revelation, which sounds very rudimentary, but I just was like, I practiced and I took a few voice lessons and I just repetition over and over and over again. And so I'm not like amazing by any means, but I definitely can do it. And it's like one of the greatest things, like just the practice of it. It's one of the most gratifying things I've ever embarked on.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. There's so many thoughts that come to mind, like growth mindset. Like, have you ever read Mindset?
No.
By Carol Dweck. Huh. I mean, I think they use like art as an example in the book, but it's talking about, you know, your ability to either be a fixed mindset person or growth. And with growth, you sort of associate with the process instead of with the outcome. And you also believe that you can learn things, again, because you're process oriented. Mm. And so it like shows people drawing a picture that they're told to draw. And then they take like a day class of painting or drawing, and then it shows the picture at the end of the day, and it's like infinitely better. Wow. And so it's not just that you can't do things or can, it's that you need to apply yourself. Like, I sucked at racing before I started, right? But then I didn't suck so much. And yeah. So, you know, that's, oh gosh, that's interesting. Do you play an instrument with it too?
Yeah, I play guitar. Oh my God, yeah.
I have a guitar in the corner and I just like wish I knew how to play guitar, but I don't practice. When I visited Egypt, I was introduced to an expert aromacologist who explained the healing powers of various scents. I returned home with 18 bottles of powerful essences that unlocked specific feelings and had all sorts of healing properties. I became inspired to find a functional way to deliver them in a new consumer lifestyle product. Candles became my medium. Voyant means seer, a reference to the inner eye chakra, one of the key energy points in the body essential to wellness and healing. Voyant is a doorway to openness and imagination, a catalyst in our daily journey. Whether you're connecting with others or enjoying alone time, Voyant strives to beautify the home and the soul, to create a haven of peace and joy. The candle is delivered with a beautiful monogram 12-ounce stemless wine glass, which can be used after the wax is gone. My limited edition candle collection is available exclusively at voyantbydanica.com.
Practice makes perfect. It's like the 10,000 hours. I don't know. I mean, I'll never be like, you know, John Mayer on the axe, right? But like, I can play well enough to accompany myself and like, and actually perform like out, like sing a song with my guitar.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That sounds so fun.
It's totally growth mindset, which I think to me has been a major like life lesson with, you know, that has bled into other areas of my life, that it's what they say, like whatever you set your mind to, you can achieve. Like, it proved to me that while you can't do everything, like you can't do everything, right? We just don't have that kind of time, mm-hmm. or cognitive capacity. We mm-hmm. can do anything that we set our mind to, provided it's like, you know, we focus on the one thing, whatever it happens to be. And so for years, I dedicated myself to practicing music and learning and yeah. And I was like terrible. And I was less terrible over time. And then, you know, maybe occasionally I sounded all right. And then sort of the delta between the amount of time that you sound all right to the time that you spend sucking sort of shrinks. And then eventually you figure it out.
And I might not have the confidence to do it in front of people.
Yeah. 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 It's awesome. It's been like, yeah, I love it. It's like my brain is like a light switch. Like I'm passionate about, if I'm passionate about something, I'm obsessed with it. Yeah, and there's just like, yeah, I can tell. And so it's like, for me, there's like a very small handful of things that I'm obsessed with. Music is one of them. Cinema and like movies is another. And then health. So just those three things. Like, I can talk fluently about those three things. And then I can't really, you know, everything.
Got it. We're going to cover those three things then today. I didn't plan on two of them, but that's okay, because I love talking about things that light people up. And having that growth mindset with being able to learn how to sing and play the guitar and be a musician, that it affected so many other areas of your life. So first I wanted to ask that, because it sounds like there's more stories.
Yeah. It's like, it had like a spillover effect. Like what I was able to prove to myself with music. It's the same way you know, I'm essentially an autodidact. So like I learn best by myself. And that's not to say that I don't accept expert help when I need it. But in general, like I'm just a passionately curious person, and I obsess on things, and I try and try and try and try until I eventually, you know, there's like the semblance of success. And so that kind of informed my health journey in many ways. Like, you know, I'm not an academic. I didn't go through medical school. I don't have a PhD in nutrition, but it's the passion really for health and nutrition that is what propelled me and motivated me and kept me going to amass and aggregate all of the information that I have today, you know, that I've written, that fills my books and that fills my podcast and all of that. And it's that sort of entitlement to information and to insight and to mastery that that I feel like was applicable in music and is also applicable to what I do with my health. Yeah, it's sort of like Malcolm Gladwell in the book Outliers talks about this sort of the positive side to entitlement. I mean, we tend to think of entitlement as this bad personality trait. And most of the time it is, right? Like in social settings, entitlement is pretty bad, but, and in with our relationships, right? But I think that there's a form of entitlement that's, that we can apply to knowledge and to wisdom and to insight and to, acquiring new skills, right? That I think is actually very beneficial. And that's what Malcolm Gladwell talks about in Outliers, basically that like, one of the commonalities among all seemingly successful people is that they felt entitled to the success that they've earned. They felt entitled to whether it was shake up an industry, like, for example, what Elon Musk has done with the electric car industry or the car industry in general, right? Because it didn't really exist before him. Or what you did in the world of racing, you know, like, or what I've done in the world of health. Like, I could have easily have said, oh, I'm not, you know, what's a guy like me with no MD, no PhD gonna have to offer, right? In terms of the grander health conversation. But I felt entitled to answers, and I felt entitled to teach and to share. I feel like if I didn't have that early experience with music, I wouldn't have my perspective would be a bit different.
What is your definition of entitled then in that context?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it just means that in a way there's no, that nothing's off limits really, that, that in a way you are deserving of what it is that you seek, whatever that happens to be. Now, when applied in social settings, like you're not deserving of anybody else's resources, right? Or anybody else's time or love or what have you. Like you earn your love or the love that you get from others or the resources that others choose to share with you, right? And that's a two-way street in the social setting. But we live in an incredible time now where all of the world's knowledge is available to each person at their fingertips 24 hours a day, right? So that's just, it's out there. It's there for the taking. So if you don't feel entitled to take it, nobody's going to hand it to you, right? So I think that feeling a sense of like, I deserve to quench my curiosity when it arises, that's something that I think is like really powerful. And I think a positive application of this otherwise sort of.
In the heart of Napa Valley lays Somnium, which means to dream in Latin. The Somnium Vineyard Estate is an extension of the love and intensity that I pour into everything I do. To experience our wines, visit somniumwine.com and use the code Somnium to receive a $10 flat shipping rate. Please drink responsibly.
This concept that can otherwise have a negative connotation.
Yeah, I like that. I like that definition a lot. All right. Well, movies. Like, okay, first off, just name your favorite movie. Let's just start there.
Oh God, that's so hard.
Okay, name your top three.
Okay. well, I love God, off the top of my head, I mean, it's like when a musician is like playing a show, the reason why they have a set list is because when the spotlight is like actually on you, you forget all the songs you've ever written. And so it's sort of like similar when you're put on the spot about like your favorite like movies or songs. But I guess like I'm a huge fan of V for Vendetta.
Oh, good.
That was an incredible movie. I love the dialogue in that film. And the sort of the philosophical undertones and the sort of, I'm drawn to more moody themes, darker kind of themes in movies, dystopias, you know, portraits of like, of dystopic universes. And I feel like V for Vendetta is a great sort of example of that.
I love Christopher Nolan. So like,
oh, me too.
Inception might come out. My favorite movie is Interstellar.
Is it? Oh, cool. Matthew McConaughey, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But Inception's kind of got almost like that. It's not super dark, but it definitely, I'm thinking of movies that I like and I'm like, you know, there's that sort of psychological dark side to why we do what we do and how we go about our life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can get a bit nihilistic at times. You know, I'm of the belief that like, life, there's a lot of suffering that comes along with life.
It's kind of embedded in our existence, I think.
Yeah, yeah. No matter who you are, you know, a lot of people like to weaponize this concept of like privilege today. But I think for no matter who you are, like life is suffering. We watch our parents get older, become decrepit, and ultimately pass. And I think that's a really hard thing. I mean, I experienced it. And so I like art that kind of explores those kind of themes and then presents a sort of like, you know, an alternate world, you know. For example, in V for Vendetta, it's clearly this like dystopic world where people are under, you know, authoritarian control, and V, the main character, is like almost like this superhero who fights against the status quo. And that's something that like I think is really inspiring, and you know, I can kind of relate to it, that sort of like fighting truth to power idea. Like I can relate to it with my work in health, and so those kinds of like themes speak to me.
Did you ever watch Dexter?
You know, I never did.
Yeah, it seems like totally right up your alley. Like, it's about this guy that just freaking murders everyone, but he's doing it for the right reasons. Like, he's he's like a good murderer.
It's funny you bring that up, because actually you reminded me of my other favorite. It's not a movie, but it's like TV, long form TV. 6 Feet Under is one of my favorite shows of all time.
Oh, wow.
And I think one of the major reasons why I didn't watch Dexter is because, to me, Michael C. Hall, who plays the gay younger Fisher brother in 6 Feet Under, I never wanted to see him as anything but that. And so, and he's a star.
You love to just enter the world. I'm just going to stay in that world.
Yeah, pretty much.
That world like it is. And then we'll go to a different world. Okay.
Yeah, because it betrays the illusion. You know, like I see movies almost as a form of truth, which they are really. And so 6 Feet Under is like a perfect example of that. And so when I catch those actors in other projects, and especially if the projects aren't like thematically similar or if they're bad, it kind of like bursts the bubble for me, which makes me, you know, it's like a little bit of cognitive dissonance, which I don't
know.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that. Okay. All right, cool. Yeah. So health, that's the third bucket. Hot minute here. Wait, I first have to start off with, what the hell is in this smoothie that everyone loves? This purple smoothie.
Yes. Okay. So I launched a smoothie with Earth Bar, which is where, what state are you in, by the way?
I'm in Arizona.
Arizona. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're not far.
Yeah.
There are Earth Bars. It's like a smoothie shop all around California.
Does it have food too? I feel like, is there one in Laguna?
I believe so. Yeah. But anyway, so I launched a smoothie with them. It's called the Genius Smoothie. And it's super tasty. I was never much of a smoothie guy, but I launched a smoothie with them, which is like not overly sweet. There's no bananas in it. I feel like most of the time when you go to get a smoothie, it's like all frozen banana. It just leaves you in a glycemic coma afterwards. So mine is like primarily blueberries, and we get a little bit of frozen avocado, which is very low glycemic,
yeah,
rich in healthy fats. and then some whey protein, which is super high biological value, source of essential amino acids and branched chain amino acids, and then cinnamon, a cacao extract that's, yeah, it's bomb. It tastes like an oatmeal cookie. It's really freaking good, and people have been loving it, which is awesome.
That's awesome. Well, I would totally check it with my continuous blood glucose monitor to, but everyone's different. That's the one thing I found is that with like checking your blood sugar, definitely there are some things that just don't spike it as much, but it's a little individual. But it's a good, that sounds delicious. It sounds like something I would put, like, if I were going to do it, I mean, like a little banana is lovely, like a quarter of a banana even just to like make it creamy, but the avocado does the job.
Yeah. It's creamy. It's, yeah. You would like it, I think. And people that follow me have been, who wear CGMs.
Yeah.
Have been posting some, I mean, I've seen like two or three people post like their curves, and it doesn't seem to spike blood sugar at all.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Good for you. A thing.
Yeah, it's like a brain boosting smoothie that also has a great source of protein, good for muscle protein synthesis, and yeah, it's cool. You know, like in LA, there's the Hailey Bieber smoothie over at Erewhon, and then there's like the Max Lugavere genius smoothie at Earth Bar. So it's like it feels kind of cool to be in that arena, you know.
So what are you into these days? Like, what, I mean, when it comes to like health, I feel like people ask me all the time. They're like, what are you eating these days? Like, what are you doing these days? People, when I'm traveling and working and they have to order meals for me or get meals for whatever it is that I'm doing, events or planes or anything, they're like, what are you eating? So I feel like there's always something in the testing and being tested and run. So like, what is that for you right now?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think I continue to advocate for, the consumption of minimally processed foods like animals and plants, which is like so controversial online. And to me, it's like the least controversial thing ever. But you know, like people in the nutrition space, they're very polarized by their diet tribes, whatever those happen to be, whether it's like the plant-based community or the carnivore community or like the low carb community or the keto community.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I guess like the things that I'm really enjoying talking about lately, my views on dairy have changed. I don't know where you stand on dairy, but I used to be like, when I first got into the wellness world, there's this dogma that like dairy is bad. It's like, you know, it's like,
oh, yeah,
not
clean. I didn't eat dairy for years.
Yeah. And I get it. Like a lot of people are lactose intolerant and you get a lot of pressure from the plant-based community not to consume dairy. And there's a lot of money from the plant-based alternative, like milks, you know, to steer consumers away from dairy. But if you actually look at like what it is, it's an incredibly nutrient-dense food. It's one of the most nutrient-dense foods available to people, right? And it's very inexpensive, and it's got all these like micronutrients in it, great source of protein, especially when you look at specific dairy products like Greek yogurt or whey protein, which I'm a big fan of. And I'm not sponsored by the dairy industry. It's just that I went and I looked at the research on dairy, and it's really not like, it's not inflammatory. Like there's like this, people think that like milk is intrinsically inflammatory. It's not. And so I've been enjoying sort of like talking about that a bit, because I think it's really important, especially when you're in a position of influence in the nutrition sphere, to share with people where your views change, you know, I mean, because that's what science is. It's like iterative. And if you're not willing to check your beliefs and your assumptions on a regular basis, then you're not really, that's like not scientific, you know, you're just like being dogmatic.
Yeah. And exactly.
Yeah.
So I agree. I went gluten and dairy free probably like back in like 2013, and then probably 2015 paleo. And then I stayed like that for quite a while, until probably last year, maybe 2021 ish. But now this sort of raw dairy market is very intriguing. And when you think about the, how much healthy bacteria and how much bioavailable nutrients there are, and it's not stripped with heat and all these processing mechanisms to clean it, you kind of have an alive food versus a dead food. And so And then I also do more of goat cheese. I've always loved goat cheese, but I cut that out even for that time period. So goat cheese and feta, because it's goat and sheep, right? So it's not really dairy, essentially. I believe that that's what I've been told. And then raw, and then some raw stuff. So raw cream, kefir or kefir. How do you pronounce it?
I think it's kefir, but kefir sounds more like legit, like, you know, in its origin language. Like I would believe that.
It's more like Target versus Target.
Yeah, exactly.
So we'll go with kefir.
Yeah.
Butter, raw butter. So all the raw stuff, and you guys can get that pretty easy in California.
It is pretty easy to find. Yeah, I think at like Sprouts, we now have raw dairy. And I allegedly raw dairy, I haven't vetted this for myself, but raw dairy has lactose in it, which is the problematic sugar that people, 75% of the global population has difficulty digesting. But it also allegedly has lactase in it, which is the enzyme. So what lactose intolerance is an inability to produce the lactase enzyme, which breaks down lactose. Oh. But apparently and again, this is just like, I haven't vetted this, but apparently raw dairy has lactase in it to make it, you can basically like easily digest it even if you're lactose intolerant. So
nature made it perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so I'm a big fan of like minimally processed foods and like animal products, I think really, really valuable. I've been sort of batting heads with, you know, a lot of the science coming out lately is really, I mean, seemingly funded by the food industry. And I think with the intent of leading consumers astray. Well, I don't know if that's the intent, but it certainly seems that way. And you know, there's this push, I think, towards like highly processed, ultra processed foods these days from our most trusted academic institutions, you know. And I think it's a big problem. I mean, today, 60% of people consume, like the calories that most people consume are by and large from these like ultra processed foods. These are the foods that line our supermarket aisles. Yeah. They're shelf stable.
They're not real. They're like not even real food.
Exactly. And they're really at the foundation of the epidemic of modern chronic disease, which includes obesity. And you'd be surprised how much like dissuading consumers from those kinds of foods, you actually get like pushback from like the industry, you know, and it's just like really maddening.
That's their cognitive dissonance. You have cognitive dissonance around seeing a character in a movie playing a different role, but these people are like, don't mess with my Pop-Tarts. Like those are my life.
Yeah. And they're all, I mean, I think they're all chills for the food industry at this point. It's really sad. And so I understand why so many consumers are confused when it comes to like what it means to eat healthily these days. So it's a big
cheaper
problem.
Too. I mean, you look at a lot of stuff. I mean, you know, things that take giant multi-million-dollar, billion-dollar industries with factories and all these, you know, trucks and everything it takes to get the product to market. And then it's $1.19. And then you see something else that's pulled out of the dirt and put on a shelf and it's $5.99. And so it seems counterintuitive. Like, why do you think that there's such a difficulty for people to transition to recognizing how bad some things are for you?
Well, I think a lot of it does come from the food industry. I mean, you walk through like your average supermarket, and there's some ridiculous percentage. I forget exactly what it is, but by and large, the supermarkets are filled these days with these kinds of foods, right? And these are the foods that make health claims. So, like, you see the red Heart Healthy logo on the canola oil, right? But you don't typically see it on extra virgin olive oil.
Right. Or a beet. You know, it's not like there's a sticker that says, like, good for your heart.
Yeah, exactly. On beets or on broccoli or even on eggs, right? Like eggs are one of nature's perfect foods.
It's like a duh. I think the veg fruits, like the natural stuff is just says duh.
Yeah. So that's why I think consumers are, and also it's like these foods are easy. They're always at arm's reach. They're high margin. So they're heavily promoted by the food industry. They tend to be what food scientists refer to as hyper palatable. So they have this quality that makes them impossibly delicious. You know, I think like everybody's had that experience of like opening a pint of ice cream and intending to have like a spoonful or even a serving size and end up eating the whole pint, right? Like, you're not weird if that's happened to you. You're human.
You're a victim of marketing, of also food science, because they make that stuff so that there's like some perfect ratio, right? There's some perfect ratios of sort of sweet and salty, crunchy, creamy, like a intersection point between the perfect amount of certain things that keep you wanting more.
Hmm. Yeah, I think I've heard it referred to as the Dorito effect.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but I mean, it's not just Doritos. You can run a little thought experiment for yourself. If you were to think of like a baked potato, like you probably wouldn't be prone to overconsuming a plain baked potato. Like it probably wouldn't, you'd maybe have like a spoonful and you'd be like, oh, I've had enough of that. But then the minute you add butter to it, right? And not just any butter, but salted butter. So you're adding fat and salt, right? To the starch. Suddenly that potato becomes hyper palatable, becomes like this insane thing. So it's not even necessarily something that is like exclusive to food manufacturers. It's just that the human tongue knows when it's attained a calorie dense food, which for the vast majority of our evolution, before we had food security, right, we were food insecure. And so the ability to be able to recognize a calorie dense source of food was actually a life-saving trait. So that was selected for in the human genome.
So if you eat food dense, if you eat calorically dense food, you're just smart.
Yeah, pretty much. Or a survivor at the very least.
Right.
But that sets up like a really simple operating system. That's why we store fat, right? I mean, early on, those of us who were able to store the most fat, the most easily, would be the ones that were most likely to survive the winter, right? Periods of food scarcity.
Oh, this brings up an interesting topic of what makes us store fat. Because when you said that, it made me start thinking about fasting and how in older times where there was less readily available cans of Campbell's soup on the shelf, you know, there were periods of time that you'd fast and periods of times that you'd feast. And so what is it that makes us store fat then? If back in those days, it seemed like there was far more clean foods. And if you needed to make it through the winter, what made us put the fat on so that we could survive?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there are a few variables at play. I mean, first and foremost, it's, you know, to store fat, you're essentially consuming more calories than you're burning every day. That's like level one of the phenomena is that energy balance. Like if you're consuming more calories and you're burning every day. But the issue is that when people take that sort of mathematical maxim as sort of advice, that's when I think people get led astray, because in the calories in, calories out equation, calories out, meaning the amount of calories that you burn every single day, right? Whether it's via exercise or just navigating the world, that's highly influenced by myriad variables, including hormones, including stress, including your body composition, for example. So, you know, to make everything about calories, I think, does a disservice to people who are really struggling with their weight. I think primarily it's our unyielding proximity to these hyperpalatable, calorie-dense foods that are minimally, so along with their caloric density, they tend to be minimally satiating. And humans we're not good at moderating our hunger, especially when all we do are eat these kinds of foods. And so I think what's really important for people to know are sort of like the factors that make a food satiating, because we all want to eat to that feeling of fullness, right? We're not designed to stop eating at 50% of the way, you know, to satiety.
Right.
And ultra processed foods, they tend to be not satiating because they are usually dehydrated, because water impedes a food's shelf stability. So manufacturers remove the water from a food, which is, water is inherently satiating in and of itself.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Yeah. As you take another sip.
By the size of my head.
It's great. I mean, like, if you think about, first of all, water, you could go a month or two without eating any food, but 2 or 3 days without water, you're in deep trouble, right? So when water ceased to be available for one of our hunter-gatherer ancestors, where would the next best place to find water be? It would be food, right? Fruits and vegetables, we all know, great source of water, but even animal products, great source of water, right? I mean, an organism is 72, 73, something like that, percent water.
Kind of like us.
Yeah. And so if you're hungry, I mean, it could just be that you're dehydrated, right?
Yeah.
But also, we know that foods that are hydrating tend to be more satiating than foods that are dehydrated.
Where does salt fall into that? Because like, I have a little bit of like element in here, and
I love element.
A little bit of trace minerals, and I love element too. It's actually so delicious. And there's a bunch of obviously options, but I do like element. Watermelon's my favorite. Anyway, so what is it? So where does it fall into the potentiality of, actually really want to talk about water for a second. Why would salt, sodium and potassium, or sodium, magnesium, potassium, where does that sort of trio fall in making you feel better?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. So those are all electrolytes. And when you sweat, for one, you lose electrolytes in your sweat. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Sodium is the one that you lose the most of.
Mm-hmm.
Sodium is an incredibly important vital nutrient. And in fact, you know, we have a lot of colloquial sayings that kind of hint at just how valuable sodium and salt specifically have been throughout history. Like saying that somebody is worth their salt, right?
Huh.
That's how valuable salt, the word salary, right? Actually, it's thought the word salary derives from sal, which is salt.
Thought it was celery.
Wow. Yeah, celery.
Really? Very, it derives from salt?
Yeah.
That's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was a very salt of the earth. Salt of the earth. Yeah, it was used. I believe it was used as a currency in certain parts of the world. Which all that is to say that salt was a very valuable. I mean, extremely valuable nutrient. You need. It's a macro mineral. You need a relatively high amount of sodium every day to sustain good health. To contrast to like a trace mineral, like you only need a couple of milligrams a day of zinc to sustain health, right? Like if you're eating the standard American diet, you're getting enough sodium, but that's because these products tend to be loaded with sodium to improve their flavor profiles. But if you're eating, if you're on the path to good health, which I'm assuming many of your listeners are, you know, because it's something that you're into, then you actually have to become cognizant of like where you're getting your sodium. Like I try to eat minimal packaged processed foods on a daily basis. And like, it could be like hours sometimes. If I haven't salted my food, I likely haven't gotten much sodium by midday.
I eat very well. But like I've found that I need more. And especially if I'm doing a little phase of low carb or any level of fasting, it really seems like salt is so necessary. Like, today's one of those days. And I just feel like if I don't have some sodium added to my water, I'm low energy.
Yeah. I feel that way too. And as you mentioned, when you're low carb, just on 24 hours of initiating a low carb diet, your first 24 hours, the amount of insulin secreted by your pancreas is cut in half, and insulin causes your body to hold on to sodium. And so what happens is when you cut your insulin levels, which, you know, is considered generally a positive thing, you lose sodium. So imagine being on a lower carbohydrate diet. You're in one of these parts of the world like you are, where it's very dry, right? And then you throw sweating on top of that, exercise, which we know is beneficial. Maybe you're sitting in a sauna. Suddenly you're like,
In a little bit. Yeah, that's booked today too.
Amazing.
A Ho-Cat. Have you ever heard of Ho-Cat?
No.
It's like this spaceship thing you sit in with your head sticking out, and it's like a CO2 oxygen chamber. So it, like, you don't shower afterwards because you want it to sit on your skin, and there's microcurrent as well. So you hold on to two wands and you put your feet on the others, and you have microcurrent flowing through your body with a ton of heat.
Sick. Wow.
So yes, exactly. So I'm sweating. I've worked out. It's hot in Arizona. It's low to no carb and like an 18-hour fasting window. So like, hell yeah, I need my salt.
Yeah, you need your salt. Exactly. It's super, super, super important. You know, and I think it's important for people to know that 11% of the sodium that your average person ingests comes from their salt shakers and the recipes that the food that they cook for themselves at home. The vast majority comes from restaurant food and ultra processed food products like shelf stable preserved foods.
Shake it on my food more then.
Yeah, it's very valuale.
And what was that? You're just going to say another one?
The number one source of dietary sodium in the American diet, it's not processed meat, it's not canned foods, it's bread and rolls. Commercial bread and rolls. So if you cut out those kinds of foods for the most part, or you eat them in moderation, which, you know, somebody like me, like you probably does, then you're Xing out like a huge sodium contributor from your diet. So it is, it's crucially important.
If you don't sort of like treat or have good water and have some sort of mineralization to it or something like a electrolyte in it, is there sort of like almost like anti-water, like it actually dehydrates you in any way? And I'm asking because like a week or two ago, I was drinking water and I was putting a ton of more sodium and I was in a longer fasting window and I kept drinking more water and I was so thirsty. But when I drink regular water, I'm just without anything in it, it just seems like I don't really want that much of it. So it made me thirsty. And not only does it taste better, of course, there's that element to it, but also it just, I was thirsty for more. So is that the sodium telling me to drink more because it wants to pull more water in, or is there an actual something else happening? I was really confused.
Yeah. Well, we know that minerals like these electrolytes definitely do enhance water uptake, and also carbohydrates do as well, like sugar can. But, you know, we tend to overconsume sugar these days, so I'm not recommending that people go and put sugar in their water. But there was a study that compared the hydrating effects of water, milk, sodas, and things like that. And what they found was that, like, milk was that, like, certain fluids were more hydrating than water itself. Like, milk probably because of the sugar that is contained in milk. So I'm not saying that you need to go and consume sugar, because we all tend to overconsume that anyway. But yeah, it's definitely true that, you know, your water will more easily be absorbed when you consume it concurrently with minerals. Hmm. But that being said, I mean, it's not a major concern, shouldn't be a major concern for most people, because you end up, like, if you're drinking, say you drink water out of a reverse osmosis purifier, which has nothing in it, right? Like no minerals. And you can drink it with food. Like your food has minerals in it that are going to facilitate, you know, that water absorption. So it's not something that I would necessarily worry about.
Yeah. Okay. I touched on fasting. Is that something you do? Are you over it?
There's like a few different contexts in which fasting is sort of hailed. And I think that in general, it can be a useful tool for people. It's not magic. You don't have to do it for weight loss. But when looking at the research on what's called early time restricted feeding, I think that there are some potential metabolic benefits to come with eating an earlier dinner and not eating too late, you know, into the evening. For one, because we're diurnal creatures, and so our metabolisms are primed to be at its most fired up during the daytime hours. So we're most insulin sensitive during the day. Our metabolisms are higher, right? And we have these clocks. They're called peripheral clocks all around our bodies that are influenced by when we eat, right? And so there's this thinking that eating too late at night can sort of cause asynchrony in these clocks, and it can lead to impaired glucose regulation, heightened blood pressure, which is not good. And so I don't have like a hard and fast rule about fasting, but I do think it's generally better to eat an earlier dinner by like 7-8 p.m. And then to not eat, after that. The other thing about fasting that makes it a really powerful tool to improve weight, it's not more beneficial from a weight loss standpoint as just regular old calorie restriction. But if you think about the kinds of foods that most people eat in front of their TVs at night, like after dinner snacks tend to be carbs and fat. They tend not to be protein. They tend to be
junk. Nobody's snacking on like, you know, a chunk of filet.
Exactly. So if you adopt like an intermittent fasting protocol for yourself, right? And you skim off those 300 to 400 discretionary calories of like what you would normally eat while watching your favorite like Netflix show, chances are that's junk food, right?
Totally.
Right. So like, I think it can be really useful. So just sort of as a general guardrail to have in place to skim off those like discretionary calories that tend to come from junk food.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Totally. My preference, totally. I love to eat dinner early. It's so much easier. Some people are hungry in the morning. Some people are hungry at night though. That's the thing too. There's some people that wake up and they can't eat, you know? And so they're just like, I don't even feel good if I eat, or I can't go work out if I eat. And I was always quite the opposite. So I suppose it's easier for me, but just knowing that, and even just working on the circadian clock, right? Just, you know, obviously it's a little different in the summer, but it's easier to do in the winter when it's dark by 5, right? So
yeah.
Eating
when it's super dark out tends not to feel very good for me. I think at the end of the day, like personal preference really does reign supreme. That's one of the things that the research seems to show over and over again, that really like you can, it's like splitting hairs to some degree. Like if you want to eat breakfast, then by all means eat breakfast. If you don't like eating breakfast, you don't have to eat breakfast. You're told by the food industry that breakfast is the most important meal of the day, but I think that's really was meant to sell cereal. I shared recently on social media that there was a paper that came out that looked at the conflicts of interests among people who were invited to contribute to the 2020 Dietary Guidelines for Americans paper. You know, every 5 years, the experts get together, right?
Yeah.
Like the food pyramid, the USDA My Plate, every 5 years. So in 2020, 95% of the committee members had conflicts of interest with pharma, with the food industry. Yeah, getting that bag, right? But like who suffers from that? Certainly not them. It's like the American people who just continue to get more and more confused, right? Being steered more and more away from ancestral foods like beef, eggs, fish, things like that, right?
Organ meats.
Yeah, and towards these high margin, low protein, ultra processed equivalents of like human pet food, essentially. That's what the standard American diet really is now comprised of primarily. And I think it's a huge problem. So nutrition science to me, it's like, obviously there's a lot of like really important work that's being done. So I don't want to undermine it completely, but in many ways it is a house of cards. And so I've just been
1,000%.
I've been very disillusioned by the whole endeavor, and I think it's really sad and messed up, and so that's why I just continue to do what I do, putting out the best information that I can in hopes of steering people in a different direction.
What would Max's food pyramid look like?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think that at the base I would definitely put high protein foods. I would put primarily animal products, but then I would also put like the higher protein plant foods for people who are
Is there a split in the middle?
Yeah, but I mean, most of it, it wouldn't be in the middle, because we know that animal protein is the highest quality protein that exists in nature, right?
Do you like high fat animal protein too? Like, are you like a firm believer in kind of like beef, or do you think chicken, turkey, pork?
That's a great question. I'm very pro beef, but I do think that it probably makes sense. Also from an ancestral standpoint, to opt for like leaner cuts. And the reason why I say that is because when you feed a cow its biologically appropriate diet of grass, it ends up being leaner, right? So that right there is a data point that I use to make some degree of determination about the relative fat to protein ratio, perhaps, that we're meant to be ingesting. Mm. It also has a lower proportion of saturated fat, a grass-fed cow. And then if you look at wild game is incredibly lean, right?
It's true. Venison, elk.
Yeah, all incredibly lean. Cows are made by people. There's no wild cow.
Well, that's why
cow.
There's grass-fed, grass-finished. There's like grass-fed, carrot-finished. I think I've heard one that was grass-fed, pineapple-finished.
Oh, wow.
I've had the carrot one. That's pretty good.
Tasty?
of course. Yeah, it's very tender. Yeah.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, I mean, like cows are domesticated animals. Like we created the cow from, I believe the ancestral cow was like a bison or something like that, right? It's not
bison.
And they're leaner. So so to me, like, especially when, you know, people's diets, you know, like my diet's not perfect, right? Like I do indulge now and then in like comfort foods, YOLO foods. And so I think, you know, I think that animal fat is like great and beneficial to a point, but ultimately what I'm trying to do with my choices is to prioritize protein.
Okay. So is that the full bottom then?
I would say that's the bottom. Yeah. And, okay. and then one layer up would be fibrous veggies, like
cruciferous, like,
yeah, I'm a fan. I mean, don't tell the carnivores, but I think that cruciferous vegetables are great.
Oh, I want to talk about the carnivore situation and plants. Paul Saladino came and I met him through interviewing him, and then he came here and brought all of his like,
oh man,
dairy and honey, and I made him Wagyu beef and yeah, all kinds of fatty deliciousness. But anyway, they totally would be like, get that shit out of here. You know, I look at my fridge and be like, why is there spinach in your fridge? Like,
I think that they can be very dogmatic, and he's smart. He's a friend. Like, you know, I respect his point of view, but just because like certain vegetables don't work for certain people doesn't mean that we have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like, you know, I like certain vegetables and I have no problem digesting them, and they're great for me. Right. So I think that the sort of one size fits all, like just eat more vegetables, that's not good advice either, because people like, you know, some people have impaired gut function, right? They have impaired microbiomes. So like you really do have to figure out what's going to work best for you.
So what do you use as the mechanism to decide what you should and shouldn't eat when it comes to vegetables then?
I think really it's subjective. It should be about how you feel, you know, it should be like
digestion, bloating, stuff like that.
Yeah, stuff like that. Like, that's not fun, right? Nobody wants to.
Right.
Like, if you dramatically increase your fiber consumption from one day to the next, you are going to feel, you know, super bloated and feel, you know, uncomfortable. And that's probably because you just haven't yet cultivated the microbiome, right? Like, the bowel flora to contend with that sudden onslaught of fiber. Mm. But people who are consistently on high fiber diets, mm-hmm. and I'm not saying that everybody listening to this should go out and adopt a high fiber diet, but it's true that people that are on high fiber diets consistently, like, they don't have those same kinds of symptoms. Like, they adapt because they develop the gut flora to contend with that fiber. At the end of the day, though, fiber is not an essential nutrient. So I don't tend to push fiber more than I think a reasonable amount to support gut health.
It's not essential, huh?
It's not.
So then if you, like, I would think of fiber and you think of regularity. Yeah. And so how do you stay regular if you don't have fiber in your diet? What are other triggers that keep things regular?
I don't think you need fiber. I mean, you know, at this point I've got some pretty close friends that do the carnivore diet, and when I ask them about their, you know, their bathroom habits, they're like, it's fine. In fact, many of them have had like IBS. See, yeah. I think potentially for people with gut problems, it can be a great elimination diet to adopt.
Super healing.
At least temporarily, because a lot of these, like, you know, animal products, anybody who's ever had like a colonoscopy or any kind of like, you know, bowel procedure performed, that what you're typically recommended is to go on a low residue diet for at least a few days before the procedure. And low residue foods are foods like beef, right? Eggs, white rice. These are the foods that are easily broken down and absorbed primarily in high up in the small intestine, right? When people have gut problems, like, I think it's important for people to, like, every once in a while, like, check out their stool, right? And it's often the undigested food particles. It's not from animal, like, source foods, right? It's like plants that their bodies didn't properly break down, right? So I think for people with gut problems, it can be potentially very useful to do an elimination diet and get rid of plants for at least a time to allow their guts to heal, and then to bring those foods back eventually over time, one by one, you know, to see what works for you and what doesn't.
What do you think, like, the top five vegetables should be then to be in that sort of next tier up?
Yeah. Well,
in your opinion, Because it's different for everybody. I get it. But like from nutritional standpoints for micronutrients, vitamins, minerals, all that good stuff. What do you think the five big ones are?
Well, I would have to say for one, dark leafy greens. And, you know, I think kale can be, I happen to like kale, but I know that it can
kale
be.
Kale is so divisive.
So divisive, yeah. But I'm not recommending that. I'm saying that, like, I like it. I don't really have, you know, any major issue digesting it. But
Dave Asprey is just going to burn you on this one.
I think arugula is phenomenal. I love romaine arugula. Lettuce, yeah. Mixed greens, all great. All great. And super nutrient dense. Because they're rich in folate and vitamin C, but they provide very few calories, which increases their nutrient density, right, by definition. And we know that people who eat a bowl of dark leafy greens every day have more youthful brains, so brains that perform up to 11 years younger. Huh. Yeah, about a bowl, a serving and a third, I believe, of dark leafy greens every day.
That's becoming more and more important for people like us.
Yeah. And yeah, super. And again, a very nutrient dense food. And so like whatever your favorite dark leafy green is, by all means, go for it. Yeah. Iceberg lettuce doesn't count.
No, totally not. It's just water.
Yeah.
So dark leafy greens, that's one.
Well, I would probably put like fruit there as well. Like in that.
Fruit goes in the vegetable category. Okay.
Yeah. Like in this, I guess we could divide that, you know, like, well, fruits and vegetables like berries and avocados, I think are. Olives, berries, avocados, and olives are amazing fruits.
Uh-huh.
Very like good data on them. Love also, those. Cacao. Cacao is also a fruit.
It's true.
Yeah.
So, other than leafy greens, you're like, screw you, carrots. Screw you, nightshades.
Carrots are great. Yeah, I mean, I love onions.
Don't just let me keep
alliums.
Up. Mushrooms.
Mushrooms are good. Oh. Alliums are great.
What are alliums?
So garlic, leeks, onions, shallots, those are all alliums. Great source of prebiotic fiber.
Yeah, that's why I get leeks. I didn't know why, though. I just heard it, and I was like, ooh, get leeks. It's a prebiotic.
Leeks are bomb.
Jicama?
Jicama's great. I love jicama. I happen to love fennel. You know, it's like
fennel.
Yeah.
It's my favorite. I love, love, love fennel. I mix salads with arugula. I love it raw.
Yeah, yep. Me too.
I don't cook it. It's always raw. Arugula and fennel and radicchio and those are like the base ingredients.
Yeah, so freaking good. Like I'm obsessed. See, I think that a lot of these carnivores, they grew up with like parents that just didn't know how to cook vegetables properly, you know? So they were the kids that grew up on, they had like whatever their diet was at 12 years old, you know, they've just stuck with. And they learned at a certain point that hot dogs weren't good for them. But in general, it's like, you know, they're grossed out by the idea of eating vegetables. But I grew up, my mom was largely vegetarian and knew how to season vegetables properly, would put a ton of salt and garlic on them. And so I grew up really enjoying veggies.
Yeah, I agree. It's the preparation of them. And like the argument on that side would be like, would you eat it if it didn't have anything on it? You know, and I'm like, kind of. Okay, so we've got like meat of all kinds, including fish, I'm sure.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Proteins.
Yep.
Then you've got fruit, vegetables. What's next? Are we to wine yet? Because if we're not to like chocolate and wine, I just, you know.
Chocolate? We could put chocolate on the third tier. I would put like extra virgin olive oil maybe on the third tier as well. It's not a nutrient dense food, but I think it is a functional food in many ways. It's a great source of healthy fats.
What do you think about MCT oil and sort of the brain, you know, ketosis and brain activation with MCT oil? You think that gets any kind of ranking?
I wouldn't say that most people need to be consuming it on a regular basis because it does convert to ketones after we ingest it. And then there is sort of that ketone push to the brain post ingestion. Like it's, you know, those ketones are pushed into the brain. But I think it's more useful to make your own ketones, which you don't have to be on a ketogenic diet to do that. You know, somebody on a moderate carb diet who's active, will generally, like when they wake up in the morning or after a vigorous bout of exercise, dip into mild ketosis. So for me, ingesting MCT oil, it's all that those fat calories are only going to displace the calories that you would otherwise be liquidating from your own fat stores. So for me, it's sort of like empty calories, essentially. I do think that for people with neurodegenerative conditions like Alzheimer's disease, there is a potentially useful application there. There's actually an FDA approved medical food called Axona, which is based on medium chain triglycerides, because what happens in the brain of somebody with Alzheimer's disease is they have an impaired ability to generate ATP from glucose.
Okay.
And so there's this idea that ketones can sort of keep the lights on, so to speak.
Oh, it's like fat burning versus sugar burning. So like for energy.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's possible that MCTs could be useful in that setting. And I think there is a little bit of data to suggest that it can help, you know, like with functional capacity for those patients. But for your average person, it's not something that I typically recommend.
Okay. So what's that third tier then? Just olive oil and chocolate?
Let's put chocolate.
Polyphenols. It's the polyphenol sort of level to the pyramid.
Coffee.
Polyphenols, right?
Yeah.
Wine.
I would put at the top, because wine is like one of these things that I enjoy. I enjoy a good, you know, glass of wine as much as the next person. And I think that there was this thinking for a while that moderate drinking was actually good for you. But I think that that newer data has kind of overturned that thinking. And I think
It's just, it broke up. I couldn't hear you. So on to the next. No, I'm just kidding. Damn it. Really? Like I make wine. So I really want you to say wine.
Do you?
Consumed on a rate. Yeah. I have two different wines actually.
Can you
I have
send
a Napa
some?
Valley wine. Huh?
I want some.
Yeah, you want some. I will send you some. Do you have any particular fit? I make Cab, Sauv Blanc, Rosé, and then I also have a French Rosé that's made in Provence.
That's amazing. I didn't know that. Wow. That's huge. Holy cow.
Yeah.
No, I think wine, look, I think wine is great. I drink it occasionally, but
do you like red?
Yeah, red is
okay. Well, my estate wine's organic as well, so
this idea of perfection is an impossible ideal, right?
And yeah.
And wine is like one of these things that humans, you know, for millennia have consumed. And, you know, I think that there's like, there are non-trivial, perhaps non-nutritional benefits associated with wine. It's a great thing to share with friends. It's a social lubricant. It's like, you know, it's a de-stressor. And all those are meaningful, potentially meaningful benefits. And so I'm not, you know, like, I'm not anti-wine. I definitely enjoy it. But I think it's like if you can drink healthily, like if you can do it with like organic, lower sugar, all that stuff, you know, don't let it.
Lower sugar tends to mean lower alcohol. Like there's a balancing act with wine. And so when it's lower sugar, it tends to be lower alcohol. And there's also something called residual sugar. And so that's kind of what we're talking about. And with lots of wines, high quality wines, there's no residual sugar, just an alcohol calorie, really. And so the negative effects tend to be just hangovers from too much alcohol.
From too much alcohol, yeah.
Yeah.
And like,
because it's 15.5% instead of 12.5%. So you're drunker.
Right. How do you prevent a hangover? I mean, you must know like better than more than the rest of us if you're, you know,
Actually, one of the best tricks is to take activated charcoal before you go to bed.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then if you get in the real weeds the next day, you need to always have Zofran on hand.
What's that?
It's a anti-nausea medicine.
Wow.
It's something prescribed for like cancer patients or, you know, sometimes like I had NAD treatments done. And so they'll give me some Zofran to start and then do the NAD because it makes you feel like shit. So it can kind of kills the neurotransmitter from your stomach to your head. So you don't know you're sick.
Whoa.
So yeah, so if you're really in the weeds, you just need to have Zofran. It's like the adult tip for life. Like always have some Zofran.
Wow.
Activated charcoal at night, two or three of those at night before you go to bed. If you've been drinking, sometimes, I mean, even if you've only had two drinks, let's say, sometimes that can still create a little bit of like a haziness in the morning where you're like, I know I drank. You can wake up in the morning after taking a couple activated charcoal and feel like you didn't drink at all.
Amazing. I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't drink that often, but I definitely, like, a couple times a month have, you know, red wine or tequila.
Yeah.
And that's really good to know.
I love tequila too.
Yeah. It's tequila's low in what are called congeners, which are like, you know, essentially these like the components of spirits, like colored spirits that that can induce hangover potentially.
Huh.
But I think the biggest needle mover for me is just to make sure that like I enjoy the buzz and I'm sober by the time I go to sleep. So,
yeah.
So that the alcohol doesn't affect my sleep, which we know
it can, totally.
It negatively does.
Well, it'll totally affect your heart rate, your HRV. Well, I mean, your recovery, if you drank too close to bedtime, will be compromised, even if it's just one. But an odd test I didn't do it on purpose, but by nature of just wearing the CGM monitor and then also going through life is like I was on a trip. And so some nights we'd be drinking wine and my blood sugar was way lower in the morning when I drank. And so there's probably, like you said, it's a little bit of a social lubricant. It's a relaxer. And so I wonder, me being someone that has a hard time, you know, going into parasympathetic and relaxing, I wonder if there's just that sort of psychological downregulation that happens with the relaxing from it, which is why it has its place.
Yeah, I definitely think so.
Okay, so that's the third tier. So it's all liquids.
Yeah.
What's the top? What's the top that is like splurges that aren't stupid? Like we're not talking about like, you know, going to the Cheesecake Factory and killing it or having like, you know, an entire, like a stuffed crust pizza from Pizza Hut. Like we're not talking about that. I mean, you can do those things in moderation in your life on a super macro level, but like, we're talking about like your little like splurges that happen once, you know, a couple times a week.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, those would be like the YOLO foods. And for me, like I love pizza, you know, but even when I eat pizza, I try to do it like a little bit healthier. Like maybe I'll get it on like a cauliflower crust if I know a good place that does that well.
Yeah.
And I'll just go to town on that, you know, and I don't like restrict myself. So,
yeah,
you know, if I want pizza and then that's like my YOLO food for the week or whatever, like I'll eat as much as I want. Or if it's like gluten-free, like grain-free, like cookies or donuts or whatever, you know, like, I feel like you can have your cake and eat it too, so to speak. It's just like most people eat those foods, not sort of knowing the downstream results, you know, that they're going to feel like crap afterwards, or that they're not gonna be able to moderate their consumption of them. There's no semblance of like balance, I think, for most people, you know. Also, they eat them all the time, those kinds of foods, like all the time. For me, it's like a once a week thing or once every other week, you know, where I'll have like,
yeah,
you know, I'll have like what's called what I refer to as like a planned indulgence, you know, like I'll have like a pizza night with like my friends or my brothers, you know, I'll invite them over. And we know that it's just gonna be like a no holds barred, like, you know, we're just gonna like gorge ourselves on pizza. I think that's like totally fine to do, right? Because it's informed consent. Most people don't have that with the foods that they're eating. They don't know why they overconsume certain foods. They don't know the behavioral effects of these kinds of like hyperpalatable foods.
Yeah.
So, but for me, like as long as I think you can definitely like integrate them and have them as part of your diet. And whether and if even if they're not good necessarily for the body, they're good for the soul. And I think that's an important part of like balance, you know.
Yeah. And I think too, there's so much sort of research behind having those caloric influx days where you're not always in this, you're not always in a calorie deficit, or you're not always at a certain sort of maintaining level. There are these sort of dips and valleys, and how it can definitely, it can help your metabolism too. And it can help your base metabolic rate stay a little higher when you have those days. They're a little bit like, okay, I eat some things that make me feel better, but I'm still kind of like overdoing it.
Yeah, for a while in the world of bodybuilding, there was this idea of like the leptin refeed, deliberate refeed. Like when you're in a chronic state of a caloric deficit, you know, to get, for example, to lose fat, it can over time, it can slow your metabolism as your body gets more efficient with calorie burning because your body doesn't want to waste away, right? Like your body realizes that it's got to get more efficient with calories. Otherwise, like you're going to starve to death.
Mm-hmm.
And so your metabolism tends to slow over time. And so the idea behind these leptin refeeds was basically that, like, eating foods that were very calorically dense and high, particularly in carbohydrates, would cause an increase, like a spike in the hormone leptin, which is sort of thought to be like a metabolic master regulator. And so by doing that, you can sort of cause your metabolism to, you know, go back up to what it was before the dieting essentially brought it down.
Got it. So the idea would be that you can raise the level hot quicker than it drops. So you kind of keep this ratchet machine up where you like have caloric deficit for a longer period of time. Then you have this one little spike of a caloric influx where you had a lot more. And so it can come up more.
Yeah. I haven't like looked, it's been a while since I've looked into the science and the thinking around that. But yeah, I know that people who are like, you know, physique competitors these days, like I think maybe the term that people are using now is like reverse dieting.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm, you know, that's a little bit out of my wheelhouse, but in general, yeah, it's like, it's thought that, like, you know, getting off the diet for a day or two and bringing those kind of foods back, will then, you know, kind of work to stoke the metabolic flame, so to speak.
All right. Well, top of the pyramid, stoke the flame.
Yeah. YOLO foods.
Okay. Are there some things to kind of wrap things up? Are there some things that you used to consume or do even? I mean, I would imagine to some degree that being interested in health and wellness, that it goes beyond just food and it can get into other modalities and different things. So are there some, so feel free to include them or not. Are there things that you used to do that you're like, I can't freaking believe I used to do that? Like, seriously. And are there things now that you feel like, I'm obsessed with this, I don't know how I'll ever not do this anymore? Because I mean, those things that you did back then, or at least I'm speaking for myself, I should put this first person. There's stuff that I used to do that I thought, oh man, this is the best thing I can possibly do for myself. Bring on the soy nuts, right?
Yeah.
And then I thought, you know, I'll never be different than that. And then all of a sudden you learn. And so I'm curious what those things of the past are and what the things are right now that you're obsessed with that you think, how is this ever going away? But they could be a thing of the past someday.
Oh God. Well, I mean, I think definitely growing up, I consumed lots of like vegetable oil based products. Yeah. And I remember I would think that like plant-based was generally better for you. I was never vegan or plant-based or anything like that. But I remember like I would swap out a few meals here and there, like a few animal products with like, you know, occasionally like a soy product. You know, I remember discovering soy rizo and like using that it's like a chorizo, but it's like made of like soy. Wow. It's loaded with soy
nuggets
oil.
And
it's like the most processed garbage like ever. I think I would buy it from like Trader Joe's, but it's like really delicious actually when you put it in eggs, you know. But of course it's delicious. It's like ultra, it's like engineered.
It's
like
totally engineered food. yeah
And so I would eat that. I remember I would like drink soy milk instead of like regular milk.
Totally.
I still occasionally enjoy like almond milk, and like I had a macadamia nut milk like matcha latte earlier, but soy milk I remember I would drink all the time, and I would just get so bloated from it, like after just like a cup of it, and I wouldn't understand like why, right?
I'm so healthy, I'm just gonna keep doing it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. We get something in our head.
Yeah, I would feel like shit. But you know, I would just like, I thought that it was like healthier, right? It had almost as much protein as a cup of milk, but it wasn't milk. So how bad could it be, right? And so I would eat all that stuff. I would buy like fake butter products.
Totally.
Oh, I would also I was a big user for a while of flaxseed oil as my omega-3 source, which I know now is a really bad, really poor source of omega-3 fatty acids, because they don't easily get converted in the body, especially the male body, to DHA and EPA, which are their active forms in the body. Yeah. So now I take fish oil. When I want butter, I use like real butter. I've been drinking, like, I've got like goat milk in my fridge. I'm like a different person these days.
Yeah. I love goat cheese.
Yeah. Goat cheese. It's awesome. It's actually, I mean, goat milk, goat dairy is a good source of medium chain triglycerides too. You don't even have to, you get like the nutrients of goat cheese and goat milk, right? Like protein, but it's not, and MCTs, but it's not empty calories like MCT oil.
Yeah.
So I'd rather use goat dairy products than MCT oil, which is again, just like empty calories.
You've just changed my mind. I'm going to be putting that goat milk in now.
Nice. It's good. It's like kind of sweet.
So goat products, what else are you doing right now that you're so convinced on? What about like some other modalities, like a hot and cold sauna, ice, you know, cold plunge?
Yeah.
Any of that stuff?
I do all that, but I feel like people can, are already familiar with that, you know. But I love sauna. I'm a huge sauna fan for what it does to my cardiovascular system, my brain health, sweating out toxins, you know, which we know we accumulate. Super important. I wrote in my second book about endocrine disrupting compounds and just how we're like, they're just ever present in our environments.
Totally.
And because of the food industrial complex, you know, our vegetables now are a source of like of heavy metals and stuff. And so when you sweat, you legitimately excrete compounds that don't effectively get excreted other ways, you know, like urine, for example. Like you actually sweat out various toxins. So I think it's important to sweat regularly.
Do you take binders as well?
No, I don't. I've heard of those, but I haven't like looked into them.
So. Well, I'm cleaning up heavy metal toxicity. Like I had some seriously high mercury. Like the threshold is 5 and mine was 170.
Wow.
Last summer when I did a provoked urine test. So, but yeah, binding is just charcoal, clay, fulvic acid, those kinds of things, because essentially, yeah, you sweat some of it out, but you liberate a lot of it. And especially if you know, if it stays in the body and it's liberated, it can go somewhere else, or like more can go up to the brain. So binding with the heat and the sort of detoxing can be just a smart thing to do, I guess.
Yeah. I want to learn more about that for sure. I mean, I generally just all sweat. I think like that's super important, whether or not you have access to a sauna. Like I think it's one of the major reasons why exercise is so beneficial.
Oh yeah.
And I'm not like a big sweater when I exercise, like especially with weights. I tend not to sweat very often, but I've been trying to do a little bit more cardio these days, which for a long time I neglected, and now I'm, you know, I think I'm starting to come back around to the benefits, like the whole body benefits of cardio exercise. So I'm trying to do a little bit more of that these days.
So what's your split? Like how many lifting, how many cardio sessions a week?
Well, I think with any exercise program, first of all, whatever you like to do, like just keep doing that. But also I do think that it's important to do both and to not set the bar too high so as to not be able to adopt a sustainable routine. So for me, like what I started with was, you know, I'm just going to try to run a mile a day. Like that's not, if you think about it, like that's an 8 or 9 minute commitment, you know, or 10 minute commitment. It's really not that difficult to do.
Yeah.
I mean, even for somebody who's like not trained, you're still gonna have to work your way up to that, I suppose. But you know, rather than try to push it like every day, like, oh, I did a mile, now I'm going to do 2 miles, now I'm going to do 3 miles. I just know how my brain works. And if I got to a point where I was doing 4 miles, at some point I'd be like, oh, I don't really, you know, fuck, I don't really feel like doing 4 miles today, you know?
True. It becomes too big of a hurdle. You have to sort
of a hurdle.
You have to make it accessible.
Accessible. Yeah. And like something that you can like do again and again and again. So for me, it's like, if I could just do a mile, that's it. That's like that's better than nothing. Right. So, and I don't really love running. Like I like it now because I've gotten my cardiovascular, like my aerobic base, to a point where like it's actually fairly easy for me to do a mile now. But yeah, I don't really try to push it like every day. I just try to make sure that I'm doing a mile.
Yeah.
And I feel really good about that. You know,
that's a great lesson. Make it accessible. Keep it so that it's within reach, because otherwise it'll be discouraging. I love that.
Yeah, just a mile. And like it might take you 10 or 11 minutes at first, but like eventually you'll be able to, as you get more used to it, you know. Also, I think what's key is like good running shoes. So get yourself a pair of those. But yeah, just like try to do a mile. Try to do a mile a day. Like if you could do a mile a day, I do a treadmill. I like running on a treadmill more than I like running outside. So, but yeah, I've been doing it most days, and it's great. Some days, if I feel really energetic and I'm at the mile, I'm like, okay, I could, I'm feeling good. Why stop now? I'll do a mile and a half. But the next day, I again go back to, let's just see if we could do a mile. You know, it's not like I build these like impossible or like these ever, it's not like, you know, the expectation that I have of myself increases with every workout. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, mm-hmm. as long as I can do a mile, it's better than not doing a mile.
I think that's a very holistic approach for you in general. Like that feels like how you're talking about food and, you know, how that shows up in your life. And what you do is just make things accessible, like do a good job most of the time.
Yeah.
Longevity.
Exactly. Longevity. It's
don't stress about it.
Don't stress about it. Yeah. Cause it's like, you know, one single meal is not going to sway your health in any direction, right? Either in a negative way or a positive way. It's about the pattern. It's about the dietary pattern. It's about what you do, how you eat day in and day out. And the same thing goes for your exercise.
Yeah.
So I know that I've always loved weightlifting. Like that's my default. Like I go into a gym and I'm like at home in a gym, you know, with that. But the cardio thing has always been like a hurdle for me because I just feel like, you know, I'm tall. Like my body is like, I was never an athlete really. So running for me is not something that I just like really enjoy, but I think it's so important. I think it's like important for your, just for everything, for your brain, for your, you know, for your coordination, for your mobility, for your joints.
Well, thank you. I think you've shared so many great gems and helped me learn about so many various different things. Screw that MCT oil. I interviewed Dave tomorrow, so I'm going to tell him that.
Dave Asprey?
Yeah.
Oh man, he always, I mean, whenever I post about kale, he's the first to comment.
Of course.
So, and I recently started talking about why, like, I think butter is like a super tasty, great food to use in moderation, but it's not something that I like regularly consume.
You saw that.
Yeah.
So I made a different choice today, by the way.
Did
I
you?
Put cream in, raw dairy, raw cream.
I love that.
I was like, well, Max said that butter's not all that in the cherry on top, so I'll just put the cream in.
Yeah, I love that. But you know, it's like I feel like Dave probably isn't gonna want to hear that, but you know, I'm not dogmatic, and I also am not I'm non-combative with people that have differing and opposing viewpoints than my own, right? Like I think that the whole of humanity benefits from the plurality of voices as opposed to any one single entity controlling the conversation. And me, you know, like when I got started, it was books. It was like, you know, like the functional medicine doctors that really were offered hope to me. And, you know, I learned that everybody has like a different viewpoint. And at the end of the day, it compelled me to dive into like the medical literature for myself to develop my own sort of internal truth compass, right? But I think the more voices we can have in the space, the better. And they don't have to be MDs. They don't have to be PhDs. I think, like, you know, a highly motivated generalist amateur oftentimes can have more to offer than PhDs who are so mired in their little microcosms, you know, or MDs who are trained in accordance to like practice guideline based medicine, which is influenced by so many variables, not least of which money, right?
Open up the focus, right? Instead of being an expert in one little area, it's about more being a generalist. And I think that invokes this sort of like real sort of chill approach that you have to it. So I appreciate that. And I'm sure that's why so many people follow you and love your stuff. So thank you.
Thank you so much. This was so fun.
Thanks everybody for listening to the Pretty Intense podcast today. I hope you enjoyed it. If you like what you heard today and you want to hear more, please click on the subscribe button.